Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Suta Goswami said, while traveling on pilgrimage, Vidura received knowledge of the destination of the self from the great sage Maitreya, and then returned to Hastinapura. He became as well versed in the subject as he desired. Purport. Vidura, one of the prominent figures in the history of the Mahabharata. He was conceived by Vyasadeva in the womb of the maidservant of Ambika, mother of Maharaj Pandu. He is the incarnation of Yamaraja. Being cursed by Mandaka Muni, he was to become a Shudra. The story is narrated as follows. Once upon a time, the state police caught some thieves who had concealed themselves in the hermitage of Mandaka Muni. The police constables, as usual, arrested all the thieves and Mandaka Muni along with them. The magistrate specifically punished the Muni to death by being pierced with a lance. When he was just to be pierced, the news reached the king, and he at once stopped the act on consideration of his being a great Muni. The king personally begged the Muni's pardon for the mistake of the men, and the saint at once went to Yamaraja, who prescribes the destiny of the living being. Yamaraja, being questioned by the Muni, replied that the Muni in his childhood pierced an ant with a sharpened straw, and for that reason he was put into difficulty. The Muni thought it unwise on the part of Yamaraja that he was punished for his childish innocence, and thus the Muni cursed Yamaraja to become a Shudra, and the Shudra incarnation of Yamaraja was known as Vidura, the Shudra brother of Dhritarashtra and Maharaj Pandu. But the Shudra son of the Kuru dynasty was equally treated by Bhishma Deva, along with his other nephews, and in due course Vidura was married with a girl who was also born in the womb of the Shudrani by a Brahmana. Although Vidura did not inherit the property of his father, the brother of Bhishma Deva, still he was given sufficient state property by Dhritarashtra, the elder brother of Vidura. Vidura was very much attached to his elder brother, and all along he tried to guide him on the right path. During the fratricidal war of Kurukshetra, Vidura repeatedly implored his elder brother to do justice to the sons of Pandu, but Duryodhan did not like such interference by his uncle, and thus he practically insulted Vidura. This resulted in Vidura's leaving home for pilgrimage and taking instructions from Maitreya. Suta Uvacha, Vidura Tirthyatranam Maitreya Ratmanogatim Gnatvaga Dashtinapuram Tava Vatra Vivitsitaha. Sri Suta Goswami said, while traveling on a pilgrimage, Vidura received knowledge of the destination of the self from the great sage Maitreya, and then returned to Hastinapur. He became as well versed in the subject as he desired. So if you really want to get a background on the Mahabharata, going through these purports in the first canto, where Prabhupada gives these little summary biographies, is quite helpful. So here we see a number of things in the life of Vidura. And this Muni also, Mandaka Muni. But looking at Vidura, we see that there were two unfortunate circumstances. One is that he was cursed to become a Shudra, and the other was that he was insulted by Duryodhan and left his family home. Two difficult circumstances. So we all have difficult circumstances in our life, and for Mandaka Muni, also a difficult circumstance where he was on the verge of being executed innocently. He had done nothing. He just so happened to be in his cave, which was where he lived, doing meditation. And when some thieves were hiding in his cave, he was arrested along with them. And unjustly, we would assume that there was some sort of trial, but evidently he was not able to properly defend himself. And he was about to be executed by being pierced with a lance. And just before the moment he was going to be pierced, the king had been able to get a message. Someone had said, oh, king, Mandaka Muni is about to be killed. The king said, oh, no, this must be a mistake. And there was a pardon given at the last moment. Right? Good story. Everybody likes last-minute rescues. except when you're the person. So let's put ourselves in any of these situations, all right? So here we're Yamaraja. We're one of the main controllers of the universe. One of the main controllers of the universe. I mean, I'm sure that we've all had some position of responsibility sometime in our life, some position of responsibility or respect, and then you're kicked out. And not only kicked out, but you're kicked out to a very low position, from a universal controller to a Shudra, a low-class person. How painful that is. You're such a big person, you can decide the fate of all the living entities in the universe, and then you become a Shudra. A very little power or authority or respect. And so much so that when you're trying to give good advice to the people you love, your own nephew says, what is this kept son of a maidservant? Or what is this son of a kept maidservant? Throw him out with only his breath. Right? Have we ever done that? We've loved people. We want to serve them. We want to help them. And they just insult us. Right? There's such a loving relationship, Prabhupada said here, between Vidura and his family members. Although Vidura said he's the son of the brother of Bhishma Dev. Of course, that was stepbrother of Bhishma Dev. Long story, we don't have time to tell the whole story here. But Bhishma Dev and Vyasadeva were brothers only in the sense that Bhishma Dev's father married Vyasadeva's mother. Vyasadeva's mother had given birth to him before her marriage, so they were stepbrothers. So Bhishma Dev took care of his stepbrother, Vidura, very nicely. He treated him just like Vidura's royal brothers. And Vidura's royal brother, Dhritarashtra, gave Vidura some state property for his income, even though, technically speaking, Vidura, as the son of a servant, was not entitled to rule state property. And Vidura was made a minister. And there was a lot of affection between Vidura and Bhishma, on Vidura and Dhritarashtra. Even Vidura had affection for the sons of Dhritarashtra, and he served his family and his country his whole life. And then, because the instructions he was giving were not in line with Duryodhana's political motives, he threatened to take away basically all of Vidura's property. He said, throw him out with only his breath. So he threatened to throw him out, and he threatened also to take away everything. And because Dhritarashtra was controlled by Duryodhana, and because at that time Dhritarashtra was the king, Bhishma was not the king, Pandu was dead. So if Duryodhana threatened like that, there was nobody to help Vidura, even though they had affection for him. Similar situation with Draupadi when she was being disrobed. Although there were so many people there who had affection for her, they all felt helpless because of their political situation. So in the same way, all of Vidura's protectors all felt helpless. So perhaps we've been in some situation like that. You know, we've given our life to some people or group of people. We have affection for them. They've done things for us. We've done things for them. We have a long-standing relationship of mutual service and affection and trust. And then if we speak the truth, if we say, listen, this is really a problem, they say, get out. I mean, that's practically happened to me. Perhaps it's happened to each of us that we've been insulted by someone to whom we gave our life. I even threatened. And Manduka Muni, he's being punished for something of which he's innocent. So maybe we've been in that kind of situation where we're falsely accused. And no matter what we say to the people who are accusing us, again, we assume that there was a trial here, that Manduka Muni spoke in his own defense. No matter what we say, no matter what we do, we're branded as guilty. And there's some consequence. We have some loss of reputation or trust. Even if we're later exonerated, people may always wonder, wow, I wonder if there was any truth to that. How painful that feels. So to lose one's position, to be betrayed by the persons to whom we've given our heart and our life, to be accused of doing something we didn't do, and to be punished for it. These are just some of the varieties of the kinds of pain. And we notice these are all psychological, emotional pain, not physical pain, that we endure in this material world. Adiatmik, adidaivik, adibhotik, the misery. And when we experience this pain, especially the examples given here, are all to some extent unjust. Mandakamuni is cursing Vidura for Vidura doing his job. He doesn't like the way Vidura did his job. So just a side note here that Mandakamuni was being punished for something he had done in that very life. He had pierced an ant when he was a child, and therefore he was threatened with being pierced as an adult in the same life. So sometimes karma is from the past life, and sometimes it's from the present life. That's just a little side note that we are also creating our karma in this life. It's not all from previous life. Anyway, these are, you can see that we're undergoing these sorts of tribulations and we wonder why. Why are we suffering this way? Why are we being demoted for a small thing or for just doing our job? Yamaraj is thinking, I'm doing my job. You can also see Yamaraj has a lot of discretion, that the laws of the universe are applied personally. They're not applied impersonally. Otherwise, Mandakamuni would not have held Yamaraj personally responsible. If all Yamaraj is doing is like a machine applying some universal law, everything is a person. But somebody may say, I don't like the way you're doing your job. Get out of here. Or I know you did this, when we know we didn't do it. Or betraying us, and how we feel so brokenhearted. So we can ask, why do these things happen to me? You know, we understand, okay, there's generally this karma thing, this Krishna thing. Why do these happen? A little later in the Bhagavatam, at the punishment and reward of Kali, Maharaj Parikshit is finding the personality of Kali, who was artificially dressed as a king, was beating a bull. And when Maharaj Parikshit asked the bull, who is hurting you? Because generally when we're hurt in these ways, when we're demoted unfairly, when we're accused unfairly, when we're betrayed unfairly, we look for something or someone to blame. I mean, even Mandakamuni, he blamed Yamaraj. We want to try to find out the cause, the blame. Why do we want to find out the cause of the blame for our suffering? Because then we feel, okay, I'll be able to adjust my suffering. I won't suffer anymore. Very intelligent. Right? When you have some disease, you want to find out what caused the disease so that you can try to avoid it in the future. So Maharaj Parikshit asked the personality of Dharma, the bull, what is the cause? So Dharma said, it's very hard to figure out why we're suffering, and he gave several different possible causes. Let's go through the causes that he gave. So some people say that we just can never understand. The cause is just inscrutable. You just have to suffer, and you have to bear it, and you have to tolerate it, and without understanding. Other people say, it's just chance laws of nature. This is, of course, the view of the evolutionists, of the mechanistic scientists. That it's just the way things are. It's just the way the laws of nature operate. It's the laws of physics and chemistry and mathematics. They say that even other living entities are simply the products of physics, chemistry, and mathematics. And it's just the way the laws work. And it's just chance. Just by chance that we're betrayed or we're accused wrongly or we lose our position and reputation. Just chance. Some people do and some people don't. No one's really responsible. So if you just say it's inscrutable, I just can't understand it, then there's really nothing you can do except just try to bear it. If you say that the cause is the laws of material nature, then the way to conquer suffering is to try to control the laws of material nature, which is, of course, what modern technological society is all about. That suffering is due to impersonal chance laws of physics, chemistry, and mathematics that just happened to arise when the universe exploded. And if we can figure them out, if we can figure out the chemical, physical, and mathematical secrets behind the laws, then we can manipulate the material energy and get rid of suffering. That's kind of modern society in a nutshell. Other people say that, well, there really isn't any suffering. Everything is Brahman. Sarva kalam idam Brahma. Everything is Brahman. Matter doesn't exist. Jagan mitya. Brahma satyam jagan mitya, they say. That the universe is false. My body is false. My sense of identity is false. It just doesn't have any existence. We are all Brahman. And all conceptions of suffering just don't exist at all. So people who have this philosophy, the way they try to get rid of suffering is by destroying their individual existence, either by dissolving their self completely into a void like the Buddhists, or by merging into Brahman like the Brahmavadis, by cultivating knowledge. Then other people say the source of suffering is that there's a law of karma and reincarnation. So these people are also talking about universal laws, just like the mechanistic scientists, but they're talking about a more subtle law. So instead of just talking about the laws of physics, chemistry, and mathematics, they're talking about a subtle law of transmigration. They're saying actions come about, reactions come about because of our own actions, and things appear to be blind because we don't necessarily see what action caused our reaction. Just like Mandukya Muni, he couldn't understand, what did I do? What sinful action did I do to bring about this reaction? Now, of course, he was in a pretty good position because by his mystic or spiritual acumen, he was able to go directly to Yamaraj and ask him, hey, what's going on? I mean, you ever wanted to do that? I've wanted to do that. I wanted to just go and knock on Yamaraj's door and say, hey, what's up? How come this is happening to me? What's going on? What did I do? Why don't we have a sit down and have a talk about this? Right? And have you ever wanted to say to Yamaraj, hey, I don't really agree with your judgment. You know, I don't think this thing I did was really that bad enough to get this reaction. I mean, I'm really a good person. So Mandukya Muni had the ability to do that. You know, he could go to Yamaraj and not only could he talk it over and disagree with Yamaraj. I mean, if I went to talk with Yamaraj and talk it over and I said, look, Yamaraj, I don't really think I deserve this. And if he said, well, yes, you do, and that's my judgment, I would just have to take it. But Mandukya Muni didn't have to just take it. He could say, I don't agree with you, and I'm going to punish you. He's such a powerful sage. So people think it's the law of reincarnation, and those people who think like that often admit to the existence of the devas or even to the existence of God. But they often understand these laws to be somewhat mechanical. And there's a whole philosophy in this regard, basically the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, which Krishna himself taught to Nanda Maharaj in regard to the Govardhan Lila, where of just seeing that these laws of karma and reincarnation are mechanical, and therefore, just like the scientists want to figure out chemistry, mathematics, and physics, thinking then they can control them, so people try to understand the laws of karma so they can control them. That's the whole Karmakanda section of the Vedas. And today we see a sort of parody of that in New Age movements that try to control one's karma. But they don't study the Vedas, so they don't really know how to get good karma. And they have some general idea, and they talk about being a good person and empathetic person and doing good work and things like that. So they have some idea. And then the final thing we're going to look at, we're looking at five things here. The final thing, cause for suffering, is that God is responsible. And God arranges for suffering, and we don't understand his reasons for it, but we're going to assume that it's good reasons. So you'll find this philosophy very prevalent among Christians. Christians, Jews, I'm not sure if the Muslims also say such a thing, but I would assume that they do. And this is the general idea of theists, that God is giving suffering. We don't know why he's doing it. We're assuming that it's a good reason. We're assuming that he has our benefit in mind and the benefit of the world in mind. And the way these people try to deal with suffering is trust and faith in God, that everything will work out. Of course, many times when these people think everything will work out, their idea is everything will work out materially, that Krishna through my suffering, God through my suffering, will bring me to a materially happy position. All right, so we have five causes for suffering. One is we just can't understand it. We just have to grit our teeth and bear it. Another is it's the mechanical laws of nature, then I just have to control material nature. Another is that I'm not this material nature. I'm not this world, and I have to just come to reality. I have to realize reality. Suffering is illusion. Another is that it's due to my karmic actions, and therefore I have to master the law of karma. And another is that it's due to the will of God, and therefore I have to trust God. Now, I'm sure all of you listening have figured out that all of these are true. However, none of them is the whole picture. Like the blind man looking at the elephant. So, you know, the blind man who got the tail said an elephant is a rope, and the blind man who got the leg said an elephant is like a pillar, and the blind man who got the side said an elephant is like a wall, and the blind man who got the trunk said an elephant is like a snake, and the blind man who got the ear said the elephant is like a fan. So they were all right, but they were all completely wrong. So each of these philosophies is completely wrong, but they're all also correct, because together they form a complete picture. Everything is run by God. Everything is run by Krishna. And we have to trust that everything is for the best. We cannot always understand his reasons. That things are done by the law of karma under the supervision of God. And therefore, changing our behavior will change our reactions. That material suffering is an illusion. We wouldn't say it's unreal, but it's an illusion, and it's actually not touching the self. There really is no suffering for the self at all, ever. We suffer only through attachment and association, and that by realizing ourself, we will not have any suffering. And that the laws of karma and the will of God are executed through the laws of chemistry, physics, and mathematics. And an understanding of those laws also helps us to deal with suffering. And it is also true that in an ultimate sense, the conditioned living entity, while in a gross material body, is never going to fully understand these subtle things. When we're in the material body, and when we're conditioned by the modes of nature, our ability to understand these things is limited. And therefore, tons of tikshastra to some extent, we have to tolerate it. All right, that gives us the immediate cause. Then there's the greater question of why, because what we've talked so far is more the mechanics of why. You know, if you see a car going down the street, why is it moving? Well, you could say it's moving because there's a person putting their foot on the gas pedal, and there's combustion taking place in the engine, and it's moving the axles, which is moving the wheels, and that's why it's moving. Then if you also ask why it's moving because the driver wants to get to some destination. So the five causes we've looked at so far, the will of God, karma, illusion, the gross laws of nature, and we just don't know. Those are all talking about the mechanics of it. I suffer because God puts his finger on my arm to break it, or I suffer because the demigods giving me my karma put their finger on my arm to break it, or I suffer because by the laws of physics, when you slip on a wet pavement and fall on your arm, you break it, or I'm suffering because I have attachment to the body. Those are all the mechanics, but the bigger question is, what's the purpose? What's the destination? The destination, believe it or not, of suffering is bliss. Say, what? Huh? How does that make any sense? Om Agyana Tinirandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshanam Vitanya Sena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So if you have some infection in your eye, the doctor may put in a medicine that stings to bring you to health. So one of my godbrothers, Mahadevi Prabhu, just recently posted something on his Facebook about how he's trying to exercise to lose weight. And he said, it's so easy to get fat, and it's so difficult to lose the weight. So I said, yes, all of our material attachments are like that. Once we've become attached to the material world, which remember is one of the causes of our suffering, attachment to something that's illusion, in order to free us from that attachment, there has to be some pain. There has to be some austerity. This word tapa, which means both pain and austerity. Now, if I'm holding on to something, I'm holding on to a knife that's cutting my hand. So there may be some pain taking this knife from my hand. Now, the pain is caused by my holding the knife. Pain is not really caused by removing the knife. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati talks about the person who's holding onto a tree and asking someone else to let him go. The pain is not caused by Krishna removing the attachment. The pain is caused by our trying to hold on to the attachment while he removes it. But we experience that as pain. For a materially attached conditioned soul, the process of coming to unlimited ecstasy, anandam buddhivardhanam, is experienced at least in the beginning stages as pain and the suffering. So that is the purpose. The purpose is to bring us back to our life of eternal bliss. And on a material level, as part of that process, the purpose is empathy. Just like you can see with the story of Manjukha Muni. Why is he threatened to be pierced? So he can have empathy for the ant. I mean, haven't we thought that if somebody hurts us, haven't we thought, wow, I wish they would experience this so they would know what it feels like? So that's how karma works. If you give pain to other living entities, then you have to experience that same pain in order to develop empathy. Which means, by the way, that whatever pain we're experiencing, probably we have caused or are causing that pain to some other living entity. Now, generally, we don't believe that. We generally think, no, I never cause this pain to others. But in fact, the truth is that we do. We're just not aware of it. So on the lower level, our suffering is meant to bring us empathy and detachment. On the ultimate level, it's meant to bring us attachment to Krishna and unlimited bliss, attachment to the real. Exactly like, you know, the child is holding their toy, or they've got, you know, some toy in their mouth, and you want to take the toy out of their mouth so you can give them some food. If they're sucking on a plastic toy, then how will they get nourished? And in order to put the food in their mouth, you have to remove the toy from their mouth. You can't really put the food in their mouth while they have the toy in their mouth. It just doesn't work. So in order to give us our real food, our real nourishment, I mean, how is Krishna going to embrace us? Just like when Gopakumar goes back to Godhead and Krishna embraces him. How is Krishna going to embrace us when our arms are full of material attachments? And the process of kind of peeling away those attachments, even when we ask him to, we experience as distress. So then the question becomes, how can we react to distress in such a way that we will be helping with this purpose of achieving bliss? You notice we were talking about the causes of suffering and how people try to mitigate suffering by understanding the causes. But our interest isn't really just to mitigate suffering. Our purpose is to use that suffering to bring us to bliss, which is a little different. And the materialistic mentality is just, how can I remove this suffering? How can I get rid of it? But then we forget the suffering has an ultimate purpose. You don't want to just get rid of the suffering. If I'm holding a knife that's cutting my hand, and you're trying to get it away from me, I don't want to stop you from getting it away from me. I want to cooperate with you getting it away from me. And of course, when I cooperate with the purpose of suffering, the mystery is the suffering also goes away. How interesting. Right? See, you know, let's be that child for a minute sucking on that toy. I'm holding on to this toy, and I'm sucking on this toy, and sucking on this toy. And my mother or father or big brother is trying to pry open my hands and take the toy away. And there I am, the child, screaming and maybe even kicking my mother or father or big brother. And my goal is to get them to leave me alone and stop taking the toy away. Now, if on the other hand, I understand the purpose, that the purpose of them taking the toy away is so they can give me some yummy food, then I will cooperate and I'll actually give them the toy. Now, the irony is that when I cooperate, there's no suffering anymore. If I take the toy voluntarily out of my mouth and open my hands voluntarily and I hand the toy to my mommy, then there's no suffering, is there? Because the only suffering that was involved was them having to pry my fingers off the toy and grab it out of my hand. The suffering was caused by my holding on to the attachment. The suffering was not caused by their action. I am causing suffering by my attachment. So if I try to just get rid of suffering, that's the cause of my suffering. If I cooperate with the suffering to find the purpose behind it, then I don't experience the suffering. The suffering. Therefore, Buddha said pain is inevitable. Suffering is a choice. So here we see at least Vidura, I'm not sure about Mandukya Muni, but at least Vidura, in these two circumstances, he cooperated with the suffering and therefore he actually found it to be a source of bliss. So in the first instance, it's explained that Yamaraj actually had a desire, Prabhupada explains elsewhere, to associate with devotees and to preach. Have you ever felt like that? You know, you've been in some sort of administrative job or some sort of job where you have to deal with low-class people, and you know, you're just like, wow, I wish I could be with devotees. I wish I could just do some preaching. So that was the way Yamaraj was feeling. You know, he's spending all day dealing with materialistic people because, you know, the devotees don't go see Yamaraj. You know that in the story of Ajamil, that Yamaraj tells his servant, if someone one time sincerely bows his head to the Lord, you don't touch that person. Yamaraj doesn't get to see devotees. He gets to see only materialistic people. Maybe pious people, some of them, but anyway. And he's dealing all day long with their problems and their karma. It's kind of like a social worker and a judge, and all day long. I have a friend who's a counselor, and she told me, she said, Ermila, just use email, don't call me. She said, I hear people's voices all day dealing with your problems. I don't want to hear your voice again in the evening when I come home. So we find this, you know, devotees, if you're working as non-devotees all day and doing difficult work, after I'm like, man, I want a vacation. I want to go preach. So that's how Yamaraj felt. And actually, Krishna arranged this situation to facilitate Yamaraj's desire. So it is a fact that whatever happens to the devotee, when someone is engaged in bhakti bhajam and worshipping Krishna, Krishna is personally interfering in their life. And the so-called materially good things and the so-called materially bad things, they're all actually to fulfill our spiritual desires and bring us closer to Him. Eko bahunam yo vidadati kaman. Krishna is fulfilling all of our desires. The so-called difficult things are to help us do what we actually want to do. You know, when the governor's wife took away the Jhansi project from Srila Prabhupada, that pushed Srila Prabhupada to leave India and preach in the West. When the head of the Gaudiya Math Delhi temple told Prabhupada, listen, we don't want you here. You're agitating the brahmacharis by telling them to go out and preach. We're not even going to give you a dhoti. Why don't you go to Vrindavan and go on parikram? That pushed Srila Prabhupada to preach. When his business failed, the business he hoped that would supply the money for his preaching program, that was Prabhupada's plan. I'm going to do what my spiritual master wants. I'm going to make money in my business. When the business failed, that pushed Srila Prabhupada to do things in another way. When Prabhupada's wife was too lazy to cook, when the servant had the day off and she just bought biscuits from the market, by exchanging Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, that was Krishna pushing Srila Prabhupada to spend all of his time translating and preaching and traveling to the West. So in our own lives, when things collapse, and things do collapse, don't they? Our service falls apart. People ask us to leave. We see, looking backwards, wow, this was Krishna fulfilling my desires. When you're in the middle of it, looking forward, you can't see it. Just like when you're on a journey. Until you get very close to the destination, you can't see it. But looking backwards, you can put everything together. Oh, this was Krishna fulfilling my desire. So the devotee reacts by seeing Krishna's hand is behind this, and he's going to use this situation to lead me to fulfilling my spiritual desires in his service, and even fulfilling my material desires. And you might say, well, you know, why doesn't Krishna just let us know from the beginning? Because, frankly, it's not as much fun. You know what they call people who tell you the ending of a movie or a book before you see it? A spoiler. Right? Well, the fun of a story is you don't know how it's going to end. Or even if you know it's going to end well, you don't know how it's going to end well. So this mentality is the mentality of the people in Goloka Vrindavan and Gokula Vrindavan. You know, when Indra is pouring the rain and flooding Vrindavan, the residents of Vrindavan, they don't know how it's going to work out. They know that Krishna is going to save them. I mean, they know in that sense. Like if you're watching a Superman movie, you know that Superman's going to get the baddies. You know that. You know the bad guys are going to be killed or defeated, and you know that Superman's going to end up victorious. You know Superman's not going to die in the movie, but you don't know how he's going to do it. And it's exciting because it gradually unfolds, right? And it's exciting because sometimes Superman gets captured. At least that's what I remember from watching the TV shows when I was a kid. You know, sometimes he gets captured and he's in a difficult situation. That's what makes it exciting. So Krishna likes excitement. Krishna says he's adventure. And frankly, as soon as we join Mahaprabhu's movement, guess what? We're inside of Krishna's Leela. As soon as we join Mahaprabhu's movement, we are in Krishna's Leela, if we choose to see it that way. So the devotee is happy to go on Krishna's adventure. And sometimes Krishna tells you how it's going to work out, like Krishna showed Arjuna that everyone in the battlefield would be killed, but, you know, he didn't tell him how. Arjuna still didn't know the details, that Abhimanyu would be killed, that he would put Bhishma on a bed of arrows. That unfolded. So the devotee reacts by seeing there's Krishna's hand, and he uses it to facilitate his service. When Vidura was insulted and he left the palace, practically like he took sannyas, he used this as a way to become detached and dependent on Krishna. He found Uddhava and Maitreya Muni, and he became, he received knowledge of the destination of the self and became as well-versed in the subject as he desired. We should add a little note here that sometimes people think that if a person becomes renounced due to some circumstance like that, it's not real renunciation. You know, oh, you just became a vanaprastha or a sannyasi because your wife cheated on you, so that's not real renunciation. That's not true. Whatever is our impetus for real renunciation, it doesn't mean our renunciation is real or unreal, depending on the impetus. Vidura's impetus was being insulted, and still his renunciation was real. Prabhupada's impetus was his wife's negligence, and still his renunciation was real. Maharaj Anga's impetus was the bad behavior of his son Vena, and still his renunciation was real. So real renunciation does not depend on the impetus, it depends on one's consciousness. If one thinks, oh, I just don't want to do my duty anymore, it's so much trouble, that's renunciation in the mode of passion. But if one is saying, oh, this situation, this is engineered by Krishna to bring me closer to him, now that's real. Now we can just look for a minute, because this verse also talks about Varna of Vidura and Vidura's wife. So we can look a minute as to how different people react to suffering in terms of the modes of material nature. So the transcendentalist reacts to suffering by seeing, this is the hand of the Lord, let me use this to get closer to him. And even if the Lord's hand is related to my karma, even if the suffering I'm getting is related to my own karma, still, it's meant to bring me closer. Karma is also meant to bring me closer to him. So tate nu kamtam susumikshamana. One sees, I certainly deserve to suffer because of my attachment, and the Lord is kindly using what I deserve and the laws of the gross laws of matter to bring me closer to him. That's how the transcendentalist sees things, to bring me to love to him, to have me participate in his lila. That the good things, the bad things, materially speaking, are all ways of reminding me of Krishna's lila and having me participate in Krishna's lila. Iyengar Prabhu wrote something very funny in his book. He said that when one sees different political fighting in among devotees, one can be remembered that there's even politics and espionage in Goloka Vrindavan. Right? Chandravali is trying to get Krishna to come, and Radharani is trying, and there's different espionage. There's spies put on the road, and there's false stories told about this person and that person. So he was saying that when you see the things in this world, the difficult things in this world, you can be reminded of Krishna's lila, and also you can feel that you're in Krishna's lila, because one is. So that's how the transcendentalist views things. The person in the mode of goodness, and they see, oh, everything is happening for my personal purification. Everything is happening to bring me to a higher status of life, to go to heaven, or everything is happening to help me become liberated, depending on the extent of the person's goodness. How can I use this for my own personal purification? The person in the mode of passion, they may think, if they're high in the mode of passion, they may think, this is happening so I can enhance my reputation, so I can enhance my humility, so I can enhance my empathy, so I can develop more good qualities and gain reputation and honor through my good qualities. Just like Jarasandhar was told, you know, if you take this battle with Bhima, if you accept this, then your reputation will increase, and even after death, everyone will be praising you. So this is epitomized the mode of passion. And a person lower on the mode of passion, they may think we're closer to ignorance, mixed passion, ignorance. They may think, let me conquer this difficulty with my wealth and power and influence. And somebody in the mode of ignorance is going to think, let me conquer this difficulty through cheating and lying and stealing and harming other living entities. So someone's harmed me, let me harm them back. So these are the different ways that, in a very simplified form, of course, that one can react to suffering. And, of course, these different modes are exemplified in the different varnas, that a Shudra is in the mode of ignorance, a Vaishya is in the mode of mixed passion, ignorance, a Kshatriya is in the mode of passion, and a Brahmana is in the mode of goodness. And one can tell what varna one's in by one's behavior. Krishna gives all of the descriptions of the modes of material nature, especially in the 14th, 17th, and 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And one can look at someone and see how do they react to distress. What is their understanding? What is their knowledge? What kind of work do they do? What kind of foods do they eat? How do they give charity? And then one can ascertain what mode they're in, and therefore one can ascertain their varna. And we should make a little note here that varna is something that both men and women have. There's some propaganda that only men have varna, that women basically have no varna, that women have no varna is guna karma. So this philosophy, which is promoted by some leaders of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and others, would mean that women have no guna and no corresponding karma, no qualities and no work that corresponds to that work. Here, however, we see, oh, when those people say, well, women are known as a varna just by who their father is or who they marry. So here we see that is not true. We see that Vidura is known as a Sudra, not because of his father, but because of his mother. His father was a Brahmana, his mother was a Sudrani, and therefore Vidura is known as a Sudra. Or he could have been known as a Suta, mixed caste. But he wasn't known according to his father. It's not that because the father was a Brahmana and the mother was a Sudra that the mother automatically became a Brahmana by having contact with a Brahmana man. No. In fact, Vidura wasn't even known generally as mixed caste. He was just known by his mother as a Shudra. And it's interesting, the woman he marries, as Prabhupada says here, was also the result of a marriage between a Brahmin man and a Shudra woman, or a connection between a Brahmin man and a Shudra woman. So when the woman marries, she retains her own varna. She does not automatically take on the varna of her husband. A woman has her own varna. And if a person has qualities, then they must have corresponding work in relationship to those qualities. Krishna explains this in the 3rd chapter and in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He says, everyone will do the work that's born of the modes of material nature, and you cannot, he said, what will repression accomplish? Krishna says, our choice is to use our nature either for his glorification, in which case, interestingly enough, one then transcends the modes of material nature. If one takes the natural work one would do according to one's qualities and does them for Krishna, mukta sarva samacha, then one becomes liberated. And if one takes the natural work according to one's qualities and does it for one's own personal sense gratification, then one becomes entangled. But those are the two choices, do your work for Krishna or do your work for sense gratification. One cannot change, generally speaking, the modes of nature of the body one has. You just can't. General, some few exceptions, like this from Nithya Muni. It's just like, you know, if you buy a car, you can change where you drive the car and how you drive the car, but you can't turn the car into a motorcycle. Just can't. And you're not going to make the plane into a boat. So whatever kind of body that we have, according to the modes of material nature, that's what we have. And both men and women have that. It's seen very clearly here. This purport is crystal clear that varna is decided for both men and women. And in our practical experience, we see that women have different natures just as men do. I haven't yet met a woman who was just some sort of a blob. You know, a non-personality, non-quality blob. Frankly, saying that women have no varna makes a woman into an object. It makes a woman into a material thing that has no qualities or work, natural work of its own. And, of course, people are very motivated to make women into objects. If you want to exploit women, then it's good to think of a woman as an object. If you want to hate women as the impetus for your renunciation, it's good to make women into an object. And if you're in a woman's body and you want to use your body as a tool of exploiting others, it's good to think of yourself as an object. And that way you can control men through lust and women through envy. So there's quite a motivation on the part of men and even women to see themselves as a quality-less, work-less object. That is not fact. And this purport is a very nice evidence for that. Anyway, getting back to our main point, that was a side point, getting back to the main point, that according to one's modes of nature or one's degree in transcendence, one will respond to difficulty appropriately. Now, as we said, we can't change the modes of our body, but we can use it for Krishna or use it for Maya. So I can practice. Prabhupada says, one, by practice, one can go from ignorance to passion or from passion to goodness. By practice, I can go to transcendence, abhyas yoga, which we heard very nicely from Gujamani. The word abhyas literally means repetition, practice, doing something over and over again. And you know, when you first practice something, you're not very good at it, by definition. So we practice. When bad things come in our life, and they do come, they will come. Absolutely. We are never going to arrange our lives so that nothing bad happens to us. When they come, we'll get plenty of opportunities to practice. We practice saying, oh, Krishna is doing this for a good purpose. He's doing this so that I can achieve my own spiritual desires in his service. Krishna is doing this to bring me to where I want to go. He's helping me. And I'm part of his story. I'm doing this as part of his adventure. We practice being like that. And then the so-called difficulty becomes a source of bliss and connection with Krishna. And of course, as we practice that, you know, in the beginning it'll be hard. And sometimes we'll forget and we'll mess up and we'll go back to our whatever our personal materialistic way is of dealing with difficulty. And then again, we'll remember and we'll keep trying without becoming, what is it, determination, the mode of goodness is steadfast by yoga practice. Gradually become so determined and so faithful that we become nishtha, we become fixed. And in the point of becoming fixed, then brahma-bhuta prasannatma. Then we become fully joyful. And then there is no suffering. Although externally, somebody else may look at our life and say, wow, you're suffering on that platform? There's not even a question of any suffering. It's not that suffering is turned into bliss. It's just only bliss. It's just varieties of bliss. So that's in our hands, how we choose to react. Krishna is doing his part of bringing us to him through materially good things and materially bad things, whatever is most expeditious at the time. And it's our part as to react to all of those as loving, to practice that. And because it's our natural state, by practicing it, after a while it will come automatically. And just doing that one thing, Brahma says, Dayabhak, we inherit the kingdom of God because it's our natural position. Just that one thing. Just to see all of the difficulties as doorways. Oh, it's like you're leaning against the wall and all of a sudden the door opens. You may fall through it. Maybe you fall through the door, but you know what? You see the door. And as we see everything like that, then we come back to our natural position of love for Krishna. So these stories can give us great inspiration. The story of Vidura. How Vidura was cursed to lose his position. How Vidura was insulted, practically threatened with all of his possessions being removed. And how he used both of those circumstances to achieve what he wanted. And to come closer to Krishna. And to literally be part of Krishna's lila. Because this was literally part of Krishna's lila, and we also can be literally in part of Krishna's lila. So I have a little less time than today than I usually do for questions.
I have some here.
Okay, all right. I've just unmuted everybody on free conferencing. So any questions or comments?
I'll ask a question.
Go ahead.
No one else has one. You were mentioning that in this material world there really is no suffering, that suffering is actually an illusion. What is it that we're experiencing if there is no suffering, the soul isn't experiencing? What is the experience that we experience that appears to be suffering?
So I assume you've read a book, a storybook in your life, or watched a story movie in your life?
Yes, I have.
Have you ever, during the course of watching that movie or reading that book, experienced suffering because the character in the movie was experiencing, or the book was experiencing suffering?
Yes.
Exactly like that.
Good example.
Exactly. So what were you doing? You were sitting in the movie theater or on your couch or whatever. So you actually were not experiencing that suffering on a technical level. But emotionally and even physiologically, you might have been experiencing that suffering.
When
the character in the book or the movie is captured by the bad guys and at the point of death, you know, you may be sweating and your heartbeat may be increasing. So even physiologically, you're identifying with the character. But are you actually suffering? No. Not at all. So it's the difference is that Krishna's illusion is a lot better than anything they can do in the movies. You know, so the movies now, they can do, what do they do for that Avatar? An IMAX 3D? I saw a documentary IMAX 3D with my mother many years ago. And, you know, it actually looks like the water was splashing over you. And I've heard now in some theaters when that happens, they have sprinklers and sprinkle you. And they'll have, you know, bass speakers under the seats that rumble when the train goes by, so you feel a vibration. So, you know, they're getting pretty expert in the movie theaters, and they have these virtual computer games where, like, you can put on gloves and put on a headset so that you really feel like when you move your arm, you know, the character moves their arm. But the modern technologists have not taken us to the point yet where we 100% lose the sense of our own identity. So no matter how clever their technology is, we still retain some sense that I'm sitting in a chair and I'm not really doing and experiencing what I think I'm doing and experiencing. But Krishna's he's much more clever than that, just like our dreams. You know, when I'm having a dream, during the time of the dream, I believe that I'm having that experience. I lose all awareness that I'm lying in my bed completely. Now, every once in a while in the dream, you know, I may have a moment of lucidity and say, this is only a dream, but that doesn't happen even every night. Although there are people who can find techniques to allow yourself to do that. There are people who practice techniques so that you can control your dreams and know that you're dreaming. But our waking life is a waking dream. It's a waking collective dream. And it's so expertly done that the majority of the time we have little or no sense that we have another identity and that we're not actually experiencing any of this. Krishna says that very clearly in the 5th chapter. And again, I believe in the 13th, 15th, that we're not actually experiencing any of this. We're just witnessing. But every once in a while in the human form of life, it kind of breaks through. Every once in a while. And the human being will say, something's funny about this. Something's just not right. I don't know what's going on here, but you know, it's just something weird happening. And mostly we come to that point by realizing, why aren't I satisfied? You know, okay, got the house, got the car, got the attractive spouse, got the kids, got the college degree, got a successful business, whatever. And I'm still not satisfied. What's going on? What's wrong with this place? You know, what's the problem? Every once in a while, the human being kind of has a little glimmer, even a materialistic human being, a little glimmer that things are not what they appear to be. But basically, yeah, Krishna's a pretty incredible magician.
Mother Ramila, yes. I want to see if I can slip in two questions before you leave. Is that all right, Narahari? Are you okay with this?
I was completely satisfied. I'm sitting here with goosebumps. especially the last little comment, only really, I guess, indirectly related to the question where Ramila said that you hit these points in life where you stop and think, you know, you have everything, and like something's missing, something's wrong. That's a really profound point. I think everyone experiences that, and that's it really should be kind of the wake-up call.
Great it point. Should be, because that's just like, you know, if you're watching a movie and the character wins the, you know, $10 million and the beautiful girl and kills the evil spy from the evil country, and now they're relaxing in Tahiti with their millions of dollars and their beautiful girl. But, you know, I don't feel fully satisfied. I walk out of the theater, or I close the book, and I'm still in my same life. Where's my beautiful girl and my Tahiti and my, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know one devotee who said, oh, I was feeling lonely, so I watched television, but after watching television, I felt even more lonely. So that's because the benefit the character gets in the movie doesn't really touch me. It only touches me by emotional attachment and association. So in the same way, everything I get in this world, it only touches me by emotional attachment and association. And therefore, there's times that I go, wait a minute, I'm not actually getting satisfaction from this. It's just something about it that's not real.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing happens with suffering, where, you know, some terrible things can happen and you see, you know, basically I'm the same person. And really everything's just kind of been okay. There's research done that if people win the lottery, then 6 months after they win the lottery, they're not any happier than they were before they won the lottery. They have some like peak of happiness, but by 6 months they're back to their baseline. And if somebody becomes paralyzed, gets in an accident, becomes a quadriplegic, within 6 months they're back to their baseline also. So we see with both the good things and the bad things, we have these moments where we see it doesn't matter. All these bad things can happen and it actually doesn't change anything. And all these good things can happen and it actually doesn't change anything, because it's all a movie. So, you know, if it's one of those awful movies where the good guy gets killed at the end, it actually doesn't change anything in my life either. And the human being who seizes on those moments and then says, now is the time to inquire about the absolute truth, that human being is intelligent. And the human being who, when those moments comes, brushes them aside and says, oh, I'm just not going to think about it, then they've lost the opportunity of human life, because those moments don't come for the animals. They only come for the human. They come also for human beings when someone dies. You know, when we're at the graveyard, we again have those sort of moments. Wait a minute. What's going on here? What's really important? What am I actually doing? What is life all about?
I can remember back, you know, practically 40 years ago when I first started chanting, was coming pretty regularly to the temple. It seems like that was the first one of the first realizations that was really profound that Krishna blessed me with. We've all probably had that. When we first start taking to this process, even a little bit, Krishna from within gives us that realization, something's wrong out here. Something's a little off.
Yeah. It starts with that. It starts with, like, you know, a toe in the door, like a little wedge of light in a dark room. You know, we're in this dark room, but every once in a while, kind of the curtains flutter a little bit. And the bright sun that's always outside, it streams in for a moment. And then we have a choice. Do I open the curtains all the way or do I close them again? And this will happen. And, of course, the more one works at opening the curtains, the brighter and brighter and brighter it gets until gradually one sees everything. But most human beings, unfortunately, you know, when Krishna, as the wind rustles the curtains and the light comes in a sliver, they just close the curtains again.
But somehow once the curtain opens a little bit and you close it, it seems to somehow you can never forget that it's just a curtain and there's something out there. And
if you open it, if you're a materialistic person and when it opens a tiny bit, you immediately close it again, you do sort of forget. But if you respond to it even once, by opening the curtain yourself a little bit, even if it's just a very little bit, yes, you'll never forget that there's actually a sun out there. Hmm. You'll never forget. Never go back. In some rare cases, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said that there can be some rare case of a person who fully goes back into illusion. But it's very unusual. Narada Muni says, once one has one time tasted, one is never an ordinary materialist again. Because you can't forget.
Mm-hmm.
Once you know that there's a sun out there, there's a real life, you never actually become fully absorbed in the illusion again. There's always some awareness that is an illusion.
And I have a question.
And we'll go on, you know. Let Ramananda ask this one question. I'm actually waiting for somebody to come in, and they haven't come in yet. They were supposed to come in at 8:30, and they haven't come in. But absolutely by 9, I have to make a phone call, whether they're here or not.
No, it's okay. Jaspreet, go ahead.
Yeah, our dear brother passed away yesterday, Charlie. And I was talking to Govinda Dasi. She was married to Govinda for 6 years. And she said that sometimes when devotees don't quite make it back home, they go to some heavenly planet where it's only devotees there. And then from there, they could finish whatever they didn't finish and then go back home. Do you ever heard anything like that?
Yes, it's in the end of the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita.
Is that the verse, Shruti Nam Srimatam Gehe, Yoga Brasa Vijayate?
Well, that's in that section where Krishna talks about the state of the unsuccessful yogi. And he talks about how they can go to the heavenly planets and then they can take birth in a good family. Or if they're fallen after much yoga practice, they can take birth directly in the family of yogis. Now, from the heavenly planets, you can go directly back to Godhead. You can come back to Earth and go back to Godhead from there. You can go step by step to higher planets and go back to Godhead from there. It's individual.
I think Jonas was specifically asking, is there a mention of a heavenly planet just for devotees? It just
not
devotees go to.
All the heavenly planets are for devotees. There's nobody on the heavenly planets that is a non-devotee.
Hmm.
If you're a pious non-devotee, then you get to go to the subterranean heavenly planets.
Hmm.
So they wouldn't be heavenly planets if there were non-devotees there.
Okay.
That wouldn't work. They may be varieties of devotees, but they're all some sort of devotee. They're all worshiping Lord Narayana, Ravamandev, or Paramatma. But you can be a pious atheist. You know, if you follow the laws of the universe, but you're an atheist, it's not that Krishna, it's not like what the Christians say, that if you don't believe in God, you go to hell. Krishna doesn't punish you just because you don't like him or you don't admit his existence. If you follow his rules and you're a good, moral, ethical person, even if you're an atheist, there's subterranean heavenly planets where the demons get a great opulence.
Okay, I got to interject with this. It's not a question, but I was just going to say that I have been doing research for Hridayananda Maharaj's his seminar on atheistic arguments. I have never, because I've been doing this for days now, a week or two now, listening to all these different arguments, you know, by theists and atheists. I have never heard a better explanation of the problem or the argument of evil than what you gave. this class. It was so good.
I gave an argument on evil? Oh, for suffering. Why we suffer.
Why is there suffering in the world? And why is there evil and suffering in this world?
Yes, well, actually, the only logical atheistic argument is on the basis of evil. The only one. The only way you can look at the world and logically say there's no God is because there's suffering and evil, and the suffering and evil appears to be superficially random and unjust. Therefore, on that one basis, you could decide either that there just isn't a God, or that there is a God but he's evil or whimsical. Kind of like how the Romans and the Greeks and the Norse, who had just a group of demigods, they didn't have a one supreme God. And their demigods were very whimsical. You know, so the suffering and enjoyment of persons was dependent on their... I just got a sense that the demigods weren't happy for me for saying that. But the suffering and enjoyment of human beings was just sort of dependent on the demigod's own personal feelings. That was their view of the universe. So people may see that, you know, there's just some sort of a capricious God. And this question is asked in the Bhagavatam also. You know, why is God partial? Why does God appear to be whimsical and partial in his meeting out of justice? And if you don't want to think of a partial, whimsical God or even an evil God, then you may come to the conclusion, well, better to think there's no God. I mean, that would be pretty awful if God was like a big Hitler. So, you know, better to think that there's no God. But it's a little bit of a problem because all of the other evidence points to the fact that there is a God. So you're really stuck with this point that you just say there's no God. You know, you really kind of can't go there if you want to take all your evidence into consideration. And, you know, we could say that psychologically we really don't want God to be either evil or childish, whimsical. Of course, Krishna has a lot of whimsy. He's useful. So Krishna is a very humorous, mirthful God. But he's not, although he's youthful, Ajam Purana Purusham Navayovanam Cha, he's the oldest person, and therefore he's full of wisdom and maturity. Just what we all wanted to be, you know, when we were young, or any of you listening are young. You know, when you're 15 years old, you want to have that youthful feeling of invulnerability, youthful energy, youthful idealism, youthful playfulness, right? Youthful recklessness, along with full knowledge and wisdom. And of course, we don't usually get them together. What do they say? Too soon old and too late smart. You know, for most of us, by the time we get any kind of wisdom, we can't do much with it anymore, except advise the young people who don't listen to us. You know, right? But Krishna's not both. Ajam Purana Purusham Navayovanam Cha. So he's fully wise, fully knowledgeable. He has the empathy, the compassion, the knowledge, the wisdom, the detachment of eternal age. And he has the playfulness and the whimsy, everything, all of the beauty of youth, not just in form, but in qualities. Sneaking and stealing butter and sneaking out at night with the gopis, you know, and lifting mountains. And even as Vishnu, you know, standing up, riding on an eagle, flying in the universe. That's a very youthful thing to do. You know, if you're old, you wouldn't do that. It'd be too scary. You know, as some old person, would you stand up on the shoulders of a giant eagle going through outer space? Like, I don't think so. You got to be just like 15 to 20 to be willing to do that, fighting with big demons. That's, that's very useful.
Mother Irma, can I just sneak in one last question?
Yeah, I have 3 minutes before I have to make
a phone call. Okay, there you go. Okay, Vidura, he is got all the qualities of a Brahmana, or at least a Kshatriya. Why is he being called a Sudra? Even if he's born.
Oh, yes. Don't we notice that although Krishna says Varna is Vaiguna and Karma, and although Prabhupada really emphasizes that Varna is not by birth, don't we notice that basically through the scriptures, the vast majority, not all, some exceptions, the nine Yogindra sons of Bharat, for example, but throughout the scripture, Varna seems to be determined by birth. I mean, it's just undeniable. So our answer for that is several, and I really only have a couple minutes. One is that there's a natural tendency in the material world for things to become perverted. It happens very fast. Dayadahi dharma sya ganir bhavati bhavata vuchanama dharma sya kadatmanam srijamyaham. Dharma turns into adharma very quickly. Prabhupada says as soon as the acharya leaves, things become disordered. Immediately, as soon as the acharya leaves, things become disordered. You know, we're like a bunch of disobedient children. And the moment the mother walks out of the room, you know, we're doing something. Another explanation is that formerly, a person's guna and karma was generally related to their janma. Because they were very careful to have people marry who were of the same varna. Not by birth, but by quality. They would do the horoscopes. Prabhupada talks about this. They would determine the horoscopes of the boy and the girl to make sure that they were of the same varna. And there are many reasons for this, because both men and women have karma according to their guna. You don't want the woman to be engaged in a very different occupation than the man, because the woman is supposed to also serve the man. So it's best if they serve within the same way. You know, you want the king to have his wife to be a queen. You don't want the king to be married to a sage or a scholar lady. You know, some scholar lady, she's not going to care that whether she's wearing nice jewels. She's just going to, you know, she's just going to come out in simple clothing and sit on the throne. It's not going to work very well. And she's not going to be interested in all the diplomacy of state. You know, she's going to be interested just in studying the Shastra. It's not going to be very compatible. You know, so you, like Prabhupada says, that the weaver family, the husband and wife are both weaving. So that was one reason. Another reason is so that the children would also be compatible. When the man and woman are of the same nature, they're likely to have children that are of the same nature. And another thing is they did it not only through marriage, but they did it through scientific samskaras. So they were able to employ subtle arts of samskaras by which they could call a child of the same nature as the parents. And this is very nicely explained in the story of Parashuram. Parashuram's father was a Brahmana and his mother was a Kshatriya. And when they got married, Parashuram's father prepared a payasa for his wife and for his mother-in-law who wanted another child. So he prepared a Kshatriya payasa for his mother-in-law and a Brahmin payasa for his wife. But the mother-in-law, thinking that her son-in-law would favor his wife, asked her daughter to switch the payasa. So therefore, Jamadagni's wife, was her name Renuka, she gave birth to a child who was like a Kshatriya, Parasuram, and her mother gave birth to a child who's like a Brahmana, and I don't remember his name. So they were able to, because everybody wants a child who's like them, it's natural. If you're a doctor and your wife is a doctor, you want your child to be a doctor. If you're a fireman, you know, you want your child to be a fireman. So they knew the science of how to do that. That's not existent anymore. We don't have access. You know, we may do our Garbhodan Sanskar. I mean, whether one takes it the 50 rounds as Garbhodan Sanskar or whether one follows the Garbhodan Sanskar given by the Goswamis and the Hari Bhakti Kalas. We may take it that if we do that Sanskar, we're going to have a child like us. But, you know, we don't really have access to the science anymore. We're not really, as we were talking about in the other class, we don't really know how to perform these sort of rituals. But anyway, they did. So they, through marriage of people of like Varna and through knowing the science of the samskaras, they were able to have a child like them. Therefore, there was generally, not always, generally a match between a person's guna and karma and their janma, which is very convenient, because if you have the same varna as your parents, then you can easily get training in that varna from the time you're born. If I have a radically different varna from my parents, it's a little inconvenient and difficult, because the natural way that they're training me won't be compatible with my own nature and my own inclinations, and then there has to be separate training arranged, and, you know, and psychologically the parents may not even be so happy and accommodating that I have a different nature. So it's best to have a society where people's guna and karma is related to their janma, and Vedic society went to great lengths in order to accomplish that. The negative side of that is that they would end up assuming that a person's guna and karma were the same as their janma. So in the cases where that was not true, they often wouldn't be able to see it, and a person would be judged solely by janma, and that is the tendency of dharma to go into a dharma. And we see that happening, of course, with Vidura, and we see it happening also with Karna and many other instances. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hi.
Hi. Hari Hari Bo.
Bo.
Chai.
Hari Bo.